contributions. We have come to the end of this debate show. Let me thank my guests. We had Director of the Human Rights for Yemen, Kim Sharif, out of London, and journalist and historian Brecht Junkers out of Hasselt.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
U.S. President Joe Biden's administration temporarily freezes arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates for review. The new U.S. Secretary of State rejects China's maritime claims in the South China Sea and says Washington stands with Southeast Asian countries. Also ahead, the Pan American Health Organization says over 1 million people in the Americas have now died from the novel coronavirus complications. Welcome to World News. We're live from our headquarters in the Iranian capital, Tehran. It's good to have you with us. Our top story this hour, the United States has temporarily frozen planned arms sales to the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia for review. A State Department spokesperson said the move is aimed at ensuring the sales meet Washington's strategic objectives with regard to its partners. The frozen deals include a $23 billion package of F-35 warplanes to the UAE. Former U.S. President Donald Trump's administration agreed to the deal after the UAE normalized its relations with Israel. The U.S. has also been preparing major sales of munitions to Saudi Arabia. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said in his Senate confirmation session that the Saudi onslaught on Yemen has contributed to the dire humanitarian situation in the country. Political analyst Brian Terrell says the U.S. is concerned about its own strategic objectives rather than the lives of Yemenis.
Well, I think this is it's a very positive change that we have a president now who understands that the COVID-19 pandemic and climate change are real things, need to be dealt with. But what we're seeing is a return to normal, and as reassuring as that might be, we need to remember how bad normal was, and that this war in Yemen began under the Obama administration when when President, now President Biden, was Vice President of the United States, I'm concerned over Secretary Blinken's saying that it's advances to our strategic objectives that this review is going to be based on, and not consideration for the people of Yemen who's are facing humanitarian disaster that Mr. Blinken is talking about as well. This is in the United States, the big arms manufacturers like Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, they don't just follow U.S. policies, they make them.
Now, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says Washington rejects Beijing's maritime claims in the South China Sea beyond what is permitted under international law. Blinken pledged to stand with Southeast Asian claimants in the face of China's pressure. He made the remarks in a call with the Philippine Foreign Minister Teodoro Loxin. China claims almost all of the energy-rich South China Sea, which is also a major trade route. The Philippines, Brunei, Vietnam, Malaysia, and Taiwan have overlapping claims. China has time and again accused the U.S. of interference and increasing tensions in the region. Independent geopolitical analyst Brian Baralytic says the U.S. view about international law is hypocritical.
Most of this started under the Obama-Biden administration. It only heated up under the Trump administration, but it's going to continue now that Biden is U.S. president, because this is all being driven by a singular U.S. foreign policy to encircle and contain China. And this has been ongoing for many years, you could even say decades, and this latest leg of it is also going to absolutely continue under Biden. And as a matter of fact, everything that we hear the now new U.S. Secretary of State saying about the South China Sea is just an echo of Mike Pompeo from the last 4 years about, you know, China overstepping its bounds and the U.S. backing Southeast Asian countries. It's also very difficult for nations here in the region, again, including nations the U.S. claims it's championing for. It's very difficult for them to take the U.S.'s involvement seriously and see it as sincere assistance and not just a pretext for the U.S. to maintain what it itself calls in all of its policy papers its desire to establish primacy over Asia. The United States is not an Asian nation, so why is it seeking primacy in Asia? This is very problematic, and of course it's very hypocritical when we're talking about international law and even international norms.
Now, the Pan American Health Organization says over 1 million people in the Americas have now died from the novel coronavirus complications. The head of the organization warned that in some U.S. states, nearly 80% of ICU beds are being used to treat COVID-19 patients, and similar rates are seen in many Mexican states. She also said the hospital situation in Brazil is particularly worrisome, with 3/4 of ICU beds occupied in many states. The U.S. is the worst hit country in the world, with nearly 25.6 million cases and more than 428,000 deaths. Brazil is the second worst affected state on the continent, with some 9 million cases and nearly 219,000 deaths. U.S. aerospace giant Boeing has recorded the largest net loss in its history after delaying the delivery of the all-new 777X jet again. The company said it expects the wide-body plane to enter the service by late 2023, delaying the jet's entry for the third time. It cited diminished demand because of the coronavirus pandemic, as well as tougher certification requirements after its 737 MAX safety crisis. It booked a $6.5 billion charge as a result of the postponement. This pushed Boeing's fourth quarter loss to $8.4 billion, plunging its tally for all of 2020 to $11.9 billion. This is a nearly 19-fold increase compared to the previous year's record of $636 million. As part of its cost-cutting plans, The manufacturer has announced job cuts of up to 30,000 employees over 2 years. And U.S. stocks have suffered their sharpest daily decline in months as the Federal Reserve says the COVID-19 surge is hampering economic recovery from the downturn caused by the pandemic. The Dow Jones fell 2.1%, while the broad-based S&P 500 and the tech-rich Nasdaq Composite Index were down 2.6%. This was the biggest daily percentage slump of the three since the late October 2020. Stocks had been in the red all day, but losses deepened during a news conference by the Federal Reserve Chair. Jerome Powell warned that the U.S. economic outlook was, quote, highly uncertain in light of a spike in the country's coronavirus cases. He said around 9 million people remain unemployed as a result of the pandemic. Economic analyst Jack Rasmus says the U.S. economy is in a very unstable situation.
In terms of the real economy, we're going to see very soon that the fourth quarter GDP in the U.S. slowed dramatically from the third quarter. And, of course, the third quarter only recovered about 60% of the collapse of the first half of last year. And the first quarter this year, 2021, looks even worse. So the U.S. economy is in a very unstable situation. I'm talking about the real economy, not the stock markets yet. I will. And then, of course, COVID is raging here. We've got 100,000 people a month that are dying. And yes, they're trying to get this COVID vaccine out, but it's they're finding great difficulties because after a year with no planning, no program for distributing this, the whole distribution is a shambles, and they're trying to get that put together again.
Turning to other news now, hundreds of people have been injured as the northern Lebanese city of Tripoli witnesses a third consecutive night of protests against a strict coronavirus lockdown. Lebanese media reported that 226 protesters and security forces were injured during the clashes. Security personnel fired tear gas and used water cannon to disperse the angry crowd of mostly youth who threw rocks and set garbage bins on fire in Tripoli's main square. Lebanese people are frustrated with the tight coronavirus restrictions. The government imposed a full round-the-clock lockdown earlier this month in order to curb the spike in COVID-19 cases. The pandemic has exacerbated the country's already crippling economic crisis. Our Beirut correspondent Mariam Saleh says a mob tried to take over police headquarters during the protests in the northern Lebanese city of Tripoli.
We also had a group of people, a mob, trying also to try to go to the main headquarters, the main police headquarters in Tripoli. That was when the security situation seemed to get out of hand, and the army had to bring in more forces in order to secure the area. And then after midnight, basically, we had more calm. It was more peaceful. People went back to their homes. There were many who were injured, including, of course, security personnel who, like we said, had bomb grenades thrown at them. At first, they thought it was Molotov bombs, but then they turned out to be actual bomb grenades. So that was something that was very much worrying. And that led to denouncing from several politicians, including Saad Hariri, who does have a popular street, if you may say, in Tripoli, denouncing violence, denouncing vandalism, and any sort of violence towards security personnel and the Lebanese army. Now, this, of course, is the result, basically, of the fact that we have a huge economic crisis, which has been deteriorating since last year.
And Amnesty International has called on France to halt weapons sales to Lebanon, citing concerns over human rights violations. The group said in a statement that Lebanon's security forces have used French-made equipment against anti-government protesters, especially since 2019. It said the excessive use of the weapons, such as rubber bullets, tear gas, grenades, and launchers, has led to serious injuries. Amnesty International France said its findings are based on more than 100 videos, testimonies, and medical records. It urged Paris to ensure that there are no further sales of such equipment until Lebanese authorities acknowledge what it called their past violations. Elsewhere, Iran warns Israel that it will hit Israeli cities and missile bases if Tel Aviv makes a mistake by carrying out its military threats against Tehran.
Israelis must know that if they make the slightest mistake, the cities of Tel Aviv and Haifa will be razed to the ground on the basis of remarks made by the leader of the Islamic Revolution. Based on the strategies of the Islamic Republic, the collapse of Israel is on the agenda. Iran and regional nations will not back down on their demand for the collapse of Israel. There is no way other than ousting the cancerous tumor of Israel from the region.
Spokesman made the remarks after an Israeli general said the regime is refreshing operational plans against Iran. The Iranian military official dismissed Aviv Kohavi's remarks as an illusion and psychological warfare. He noted that such remarks could also be based on the fact that Israel is not aware of Iran's military might. The latest Israeli rhetoric against Iran comes as the new U.S. administration has signaled it wants to re-enter the 2015 nuclear deal. Tel Aviv has frequently threatened the Islamic Republic with strikes over its nuclear program. Political commentator Mustafa Khoshchesh says the U.S. and Israeli threats against Iran are hollow and boastful, and that any attacks on the Islamic Republic won't be left unanswered.
Now, after Tripoli incidents last year, shooting down the Global Hawk, and especially the masterpiece, which was Iranian missile attack on analyst Saad, when the commander-in-chief of the United States, President Donald Trump, threatened to strike back 52 Iranian centers, and he never did that, then their hollow and boastful threats proved to be empty, hollow completely, without any credibility. So what should Biden do in order to advance this containment strategy? They have asked, at least for the past 1 year, they have asked the Israelis to step forward and to help them through posing threats to Iran, military threats to Iran, in order to claim that, okay, if crazy Donald Trump is gone, now the crazy Netanyahu is still there, and he would go for the military threats. But in essence, all throughout the last one and a half years, what have they been doing? They have been claiming that they've been striking Iran in Syria. 95% has been no more than lies. But for the 5% they did something to Iranian allies, they have surely received their response. The Israelis remember pretty well what happened to them in the Golan Heights, and they remember the number of casualties they had in there.
The Yemen Palestine Development and Humanitarian Response Organization has held a press conference in Sana'a and discussed the Yemeni-Palestinian relations. The organization revealed its humanitarian plan for 2021. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif Al-Washadi, has more.
The steadfastness of Yemen and the resistance of Palestinians is the slogan of a press conference held by the Yemen Palestine Organization. Participants discussed the Yemeni-Palestinian relations and their common vision, which is resistance against the Zionist projects in the region.
This event is a Yemeni-Palestinian initiative for political awakening and for the unity of both nations to achieve a common goal of defeating the Israeli regime's plans in the region and liberation of Palestine. Israel is our common enemy and the enemy of Muslim nations.
The participants affirmed that Yemen and Palestine have strong ties that transcend geographical borders, as Yemen has become an important part of the axis of resistance.
The Yemeni support for Palestine has been absolute throughout the past decade. Palestine today is suffering and finds the Yemeni people on its side. The Yemenis can fight for Palestine, especially since Yemen has become a strong party in the axis of resistance that is growing day after day.
The Yemen-Palestine organization also revealed its humanitarian plan for 2021, which will contribute to alleviating the suffering of Yemenis due to the continuing war and the blockade imposed by the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition.
Yemenis believe that the U.S., as the main supporter of Israel, is also responsible for the sufferings of Palestinians and Yemenis. They say resistance is the only way to achieve victory and liberation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
On Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. and make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
The European Union has threatened to block exports of coronavirus vaccines to countries outside the European bloc, countries such as Britain, after AstraZeneca was accused of failing to give a satisfactory explanation for a huge shortfall of promised doses to member states. The pharmaceutical company's new distribution plans were said to be unacceptable after it surprisingly informed the European Commission on Friday, 22nd of January, that there would be significant shortfalls on the original schedule. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Daniel Buffy. The piece is titled, European Union Threatens to Block COVID Vaccine Exports Amid AstraZeneca Shortfall. Stay with us for more of Daniel Buffy's article. The European Union has threatened to block exports of coronavirus vaccines to countries outside the European bloc, countries such as Britain, after AstraZeneca was accused of failing to give a satisfactory explanation for a huge shortfall of promised doses to European member states. The pharmaceutical company's new distribution plans were said to be unacceptable after it surprisingly informed the European Commission on Friday, 22nd of January, that there would be significant shortfalls on the original schedule. The European Union has been due to receive 100 million doses of the vaccine in the first quarter of this year, but it is feared that the bloc will only receive half of that despite making large advance purchases ahead of authorization of the vaccine by the European Medicines Agency. In a heated telephone conversation with AstraZeneca's chief executive, Pascal Sorio, on Monday, the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said the company must live up to its contractual obligations. The European Medicines Agency is expected to authorize the AstraZeneca vaccine by the end of this week. Ursula von der Leyen's spokesperson said she made it clear that she expects AstraZeneca to deliver on the contractual arrangements foreseen in the advance purchasing agreement. She reminded Pascal Sorio that the European Union has invested significant amounts in the company up front precisely to ensure that production is ramped up even before the conditional market authorization is delivered by the European Medicines Agency. Of course, production issues can appear with the complex vaccine, but we expect the company to find solutions and to exploit all possible flexibilities to deliver swiftly. The European Union's Health Commissioner, Stella Kyriakides, made a televised statement to express her frustration at the company's behavior, warning that the answers so far provided by AstraZeneca had not been satisfactory. Late on Monday evening, 25th of January, following discussions with executives representing the pharmaceutical company, the European Union's Health Commissioner, Stella Kyriakides, tweeted, "Discussions with AstraZeneca today resulted in dissatisfaction with a lack of clarity and insufficient explanations from the company. European Union member states are united. Vaccine developers have societal and contractual responsibilities they need to uphold. With our member states, we have requested from AstraZeneca a detailed planning of vaccine deliveries and when distribution will take place to member states. Another meeting will be convened on Wednesday to discuss the matter further. The development has raised pressure on the Commission, just as it is being criticized for the slow rollout of vaccination programs in European Union member states in comparison with the United Kingdom and the United States. The United Kingdom has administered more than 10 doses per 100 residents, but according to data gathered by Airfinity, a London-based life sciences analytics company, the European Union has administered just under 2 doses per 100 residents. The EU Health Commissioner Stella Kyriakides said Brussels would now insist on being notified of any exports of vaccines from EU sites, including that produced by Pfizer, on which the United Kingdom is reliant on European laboratories for supplies, raising the specter of an export ban. Kyriakides said, "You know that AstraZeneca vaccine is currently in the final stages of approval with the European Medicines Agency. If all requirements are met, the European Medicines Agency could recommend market authorization by the end of this week. But there is a problem in the supply side. Last Friday, the company, AstraZeneca, surprisingly informed the European Commission and the European Union member states that it intends to supply considerably fewer doses of the vaccine in the coming weeks than agreed and announced. This new schedule is not acceptable to the European Union. That is why I wrote a letter to the company at the weekend in which I asked important and serious questions. The European Union has pre-financed the development of the vaccine and its production and wants to see the return." The EU Health Commissioner, Stella Kyriakides, said the European Union wanted to know exactly which doses have been produced, where by AstraZeneca so far, and if or to whom they have been delivered. These questions were also discussed today in the Joint Steering Board of the Commission and the 27 member states with AstraZeneca, she said. "The answers of the company have not been satisfactory so far. That's why a second meeting is scheduled for tonight. The European Union wants the order and pre-financed doses to be delivered as soon as possible, and we want our contract to be fully fulfilled." The European Union has spent 2.7 billion euros on the rapid development and production of coronavirus vaccines. The European Union's Health Commissioner, Stella Kyriakides, said the Commission had proposed that the member states agreed on an export transparency mechanism be put in place as soon as possible. Meanwhile, Germany's Health Minister, Jens Spahn, gave Berlin's backing to the Commission proposal. "We, as the European Union, must be able to know whether and what vaccines are being exported from the European Union," he said. "Only that way can we understand whether our European Union contracts with the producers are being served fairly. An obligation to get approval for vaccine exports on the European Union level makes sense." AstraZeneca said in a statement that the company's chief executive, in his conversation with Ursula von der Leyen, had stressed the importance of working in partnership and how AstraZeneca is doing everything it can to bring its vaccine to millions of Europeans as soon as possible.
We are with you.
What about you? IRIB English Radio. To our website www.parstoday.com/en.
European News Bulletin.
Hello, everyone, from the British capital. My name is Amina Taylor, and we begin with a story close to home. Here in the United Kingdom, the country has passed another grim milestone, with 100,000 now dying with COVID-19. This makes Britain the fifth and smallest country to enter a six-figure death toll. Now, Boris Johnson's government is under fire for its handling of the crisis, with critics asking if the Conservatives could have done more to save lives.
The United Kingdom was the first to detect a more contagious and perhaps more deadly COVID-19 variant. It was also the first country to start vaccinating and has now inoculated most of its over 80s, more than 6.5 million people. Nonetheless, Boris Johnson's government is under fire for its handling of the pandemic, as the UK's death toll passes 100,000.
The Prime Minister was slow into the first lockdown last March. He was slow in getting protective equipment to the front line, slow to protect our care homes, slow on testing and tracing, slow into the second lockdown in the autumn, slow to change the Christmas mixing rules, slow again into this third lockdown, delaying 13 days from the 22nd of December before implementing it.
The government has taken responsibility for the death toll, but defended its decisions, some of which were pumping billions of pounds into a new test and trace system that has failed dismally, the launching of the Eat Out to Help Out scheme, which doctors blame for the autumn surge in infections, and refusing to clamp down on air travel that continued without testing or quarantine upon arrival.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, there will indeed be a time when we must learn the lessons of what has happened, reflect on them, and prepare, Mr. Speaker. I don't think that moment is now, when we are in the throes of fighting this wave of the new variant, when 37,000 people are struggling with COVID in our hospitals. And I think what the country wants is for us to come together as a parliament and as politicians.
The UK entered the pandemic unprepared, with a defunded and ailing National Health Service, cuts to public spending, and one of the highest rates of obesity in the world. Millions of Britons who were already struggling before the pandemic are pinning their hopes now on the vaccine. The government says some restrictions may be lifted by late February. But if anything, the new variant has shown that this is a marathon, not a sprint. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Well, Ranjit Ra, NHS consultant, physician and surgeon, is once more sharing his time with us. Dr. Bra, 100,000 plus dead now, and if you're looking at some of the front pages in the UK today, you might not really get that severity. Do you think the media has given the Prime Minister some cover here?
Amina, good to be with you. Thank you for having me.
think it's a shameful and painful milestone for our country, which remains the sixth richest country in the world. I do think our government is very much culpable. There are features of our population, its age, its comorbidity, its diabetes, its obesity, things that you mentioned in your clip there. But there are very much features also of widening inequality gap, of the economic crisis, and of the attitude of the government itself, in particular the fundamental free market, fundamentalist, laissez-faire, anti-state attitude of the government, which is their core ethos, and epitomized by Dominic Cummings, the now sacked and disgraced advisor of Boris Johnson, who said quite openly at the beginning of this pandemic that the government policy essentially would be herd immunity, protect the economy, and if a few pensioners die, in his own words, so be it. That was reported, then subsequently denied, but it has really underpinned the poor leadership, poor management, poor levels of scrutiny, the failure of our political system, really, to give any kind of decent scrutiny, opposition, or have any ability to intervene on behalf of the citizenry of our country, Amina.
Well, we're putting our hopes here on the vaccine rollout, but even that hasn't gone to plan. What's happened?
Well, if you look at the measures that have really worked around the world, and I particularly look to China because they gave such a startling example of how correctly to handle this with non-pharmaceutical measures, it was absolutely possible by targeting economic measures, health measures at the problem, protecting lives first and foremost to stop the problem in its tracks. Now, of course, we've failed to do that. The disease COVID is endemic, it's in our hospitals, it's in our society, so we are very strongly relying on the vaccine. But of course, there are problems with supply of vaccine, there are problems with rolling it out to such a large population. Already we're seeing our countries failing to honour its obligations to supply the EU. Likewise, the EU is threatening trade sanctions against us so that we won't get the Moderna vaccine. We haven't got enough, so we're going through a one dose as opposed to a two dose regimen, for which there's very poor levels of evidence. And we know that people are, in fact, getting the virus, though hopefully a mild course of illness, having had their first course of vaccine. So at the moment, a very small part of the population will be protected, because so many of those people who have had the vaccine, maybe 6 million close to, still have are not really adequately protected at this stage. So the vaccine is the one ray of hope in this story, in what has otherwise been a chronicle of really abuse of power, of corruption and mismanagement on a governmental level, with an underfunded NHS which is really struggling, you know, manfully, but struggling to pick up the pieces of the administration.
And very briefly here, Dr. Bra, we heard the Prime Minister in that clip say, you know, now is not the time for these questions, but for unity. How does that sit with you?
Very poorly. The whole point of questions and scrutiny is to be able to change direction. The direction of this government has been, as outlined, a punctuated herd immunity that's allowed the virus to spread whilst doling out huge amounts of money in an unaccountable and a very opaque, clearly, however, corrupt manner for people who have failed to do the job, whilst simultaneously directing hammer blows against the NHS for further privatisation and deprivation of funds under the slogan, perversely, of protecting the NHS. I'm afraid to say quite the reverse is the case. The problem with British justice and its inquiries is they're notoriously late after the event and don't reverse the fundamental direction of travel. What we need is effective political opposition, but sadly that's lacking in our country at the moment, Amina.
All right. Ranjit Bra, thank you, as always. Now, for some further news on this topic, because the World Health Organization has accused wealthy nations of vaccine nationalism, and they've urged them to ensure coronavirus vaccines are also being made widely available for poorer countries.
As we speak, rich countries are rolling out vaccines, while the world's least developed countries watch and wait. With every day that passes, the divide grows larger between the world's haves and have-nots. In my opening remarks last Monday, I said the world faced a catastrophic moral failure if it doesn't walk the talk on vaccine equity.
Now, this disparity is at its height in the occupied Palestinian territories, where the Israeli regime is being praised for its rollout, while occupied Palestinians have been left without the vaccine. Under international law, occupying forces are responsible for the inoculation of all people.
The World Health Organization has also made clear that things cannot return to normal whilst vast percentage of people remain open to infection. Now, international aid organizations have joined in with the global criticism of the U.S. designation of Yemen's Ansarullah movement as a terrorist group. This comes as U.S. President Joe Biden has announced a temporary suspension of sanctions on Yemen, but activists say more needs to be done to save lives.
Amid growing global pressure over U.S. support for the war on Yemen, 22 aid organizations admit they're extremely concerned about the humanitarian consequences of the U.S. terrorism designation of the Houthi Ansarullah movement. Aid agencies including Islamic Relief, Oxfam and Save the Children said the designation comes at a time when famine is a very real threat to the Arab country.
If I talk about the severity of the deeds in some areas, 14.7 million people, they are in acute need. And World Food Programme has warned, they have clearly identified their concerns. Similarly, the UN mission for Yemen, that has clearly identified that this designation is not going to contribute. This is going to contribute negatively to the operations, humanitarian assistance, humanitarian operations which are going on ground.
The dire humanitarian crisis in Yemen has been mostly caused by 6 years of Saudi-led aggression, which includes an indiscriminate bombing campaign and a siege on Ansarullah-run areas.
80% of the population, they are living in those areas which are controlled by Ansarullah. And on the other hand, the remaining 20% of the portion is controlled by the legitimate government. So to import anything, to import any relief items in those areas where legitimate government is sitting, that is a bit easier. And to run the operations in those areas is comparatively easy, while to run the humanitarian operations in north is comparatively difficult.
The weaponized blockade makes imports of food, aid and medicine extremely difficult. But the new U.S. terror designation means organizations now risk charges of supporting terrorists. Following a global day of action for Yemen on January the 25th, the White House did announce a temporary suspension of some sanctions, but the designation of the Ansarullah remains under review.
We wish that the new government in USA, they should reverse this decision. If the decision is reversed, it would be a big relief for the people of Yemen who need humanitarian assistance, and those operations will be continuing as normal as these were before the designation.
The UN ranks Yemen as the world's worst current humanitarian crisis, with 112,000 lives already claimed by the conflict so far. Joe Biden has made significant promises to end U.S. support for the war in Yemen. However, until they are upheld, needless and preventable deaths will continue to occur. Robert Carter, London.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has announced that Russia is ready to organize a top-level Palestinian-Israeli meeting to discuss plans for a viable and fair so-called two-state solution. During a speech to the UN Security Council, Lavrov warned that recent agreements that Israel signed with certain Arab regimes will marginalize efforts to create a viable Palestinian state that exists side by side in peace with the Israeli regime. Nearly all attendees of the UN Security Council meeting, including China and France, reaffirmed the need for a two-state solution under which Israel and a future Palestine would coexist. Now, the European Union has called on new US President Joe Biden to help draw up a common rulebook which will aim to rein in the power of big tech companies like Facebook and Twitter, whilst also fighting the spread of fake news.
No matter how tempting it may have been for Twitter to switch off President Trump's account, such serious interference with freedom of expression should not be based on company rules alone. There needs to be a framework of laws for such far-reaching decisions.
During the speech, von der Leyen urged the White House to join the EU's efforts to better regulate the darker sides of the digital world and tech platforms, which she added were in part to blame for the violent Washington, D.C. Capitol Hill insurrection. As Joe Biden takes up the reins of power in the U.S., which countries stand to gain or lose under his administration? The transatlantic relationship between the UK and the US has perennially been touted as special, a friendship between equals. But as Sai Pureza reports, with the US increasingly not regarding Britain as an important European or even global player anymore, that relationship may have all become lopsided. He cuts to the chase.
So Biden is now the new president in the U.S., a job he coveted all of his life and perhaps never thought he'd get during such tumultuous times. After he was sworn in, he set the tone for what's to come next.
We'll press forward with speed and urgency, for we have much to do in this winter of peril and significant possibilities.
So Biden says he wants to repair U.S. relations with its allies. He's already signed executive orders to immediately rejoin the Paris Climate Accord, the World Health Organization, to lift Trump's so-called Muslim ban. Basically, he says he's reversing a lot of what we saw in the past 4 years that started with this.
From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first.
If you're a student of world affairs, you may know the phrase, when America sneezes, the world catches a cold. And so decisions by the Biden administration will have a profound impact on countries and regions around the world, not least on Europe, and in particular on the UK and its so-called special relationship with the US. That special relationship has been at the heart of UK foreign policy for decades. One unforgettable example with far-reaching consequences is the UK's decision under Tony Blair to join the US-led invasion, or shall we say reinvasion, of Iraq in 2003, just like a vassal state would. Consecutive British governments haven't shied away from cozying up to their American counterparts. Personal relationships between the two countries' leaders have also been deep. Over the past 4 years, we saw Boris Johnson and Donald Trump emerge as political doppelgangers, getting along very well, although at one point Johnson called Trump a stupefying ignorant. Johnson was an architect of Brexit and Trump a fan. Joe Biden is not, nor was his president Barack Obama. The Johnson government had pinned its hopes on a post-Brexit trade deal with the Trump administration, but with Biden in the White House, those hopes may have been dashed. Biden might want to invest more in Berlin and Paris, politically isolating Britain. In other words, he may want to forge closer ties with the European Union, and that's something that's making number 10 very nervous. But a Biden presidency may not be that bad for the UK. The Brits believe in multilateralism as a way of confronting global challenges. They like the UN and NATO, unlike Donald Trump, who called one weak and incompetent and the other obsolete. This year, the UK is hosting the United Nations Climate Change Conference and the G7, opportunities for the British government to build trust with the Biden administration. When administrations change hands in the US, number 10 Downing Street is always keen to get the Prime Minister into the Oval Office ahead of other leaders. As a matter of fact, Johnson and Biden have already spoken on the phone. But it looks like the British Prime Minister has to work a lot harder with this administration to keep the so-called special relationship special. And as for trade between Britain and its one-time colonial possession, well, it's already brisk, suggesting that the potential for bigger economic gains in either country might be slim. Let me leave you with this final quote from British politician George Galloway. When Tony Blair became UK Prime Minister, the special relationship became rather like the special relationship between Monica Lewinsky and President Clinton. Unequal, undignified, and with the weaker partner permanently on their knees.
Do Good to see you as always, Robert Inlakesh, and we begin your particular deep dive into the social media situation there with what, more blustering from Tel Aviv?
Yes, it seems as such. We have heard from Tel Aviv, in fact, one of the chief generals of the Israeli occupation military, his name's Aviv Kochavi, he said that he has basically drawn up plans for attacks on Iran in order to thwart what he calls Iran's nuclear program, which we know doesn't exist. In return, and in response to that, Iran has, of course, responded by saying that it will respond to anything that Israel does. However, it seems that these are just statements from an administration inside of Tel Aviv, which is extremely frustrated at the fact that none of the strategies put forth against Iran, and not just Iran as well, have worked. In terms of against the Lebanese resistance, the Palestinian resistance, also on top of that, they have not been able to succeed. They have not been able to achieve decisive victories. And because of this, they've just threatened today. In this same speech, in fact, Kochavi, threatened Gazan civilians and Lebanese civilians with bombarding their homes. Now, these are the words of a weak administration, a weak occupation army, which is not able to really achieve anything on the battlefield. And so this is more posturing, a lot of people have said, to the United States in order to try and get Biden to not rejoin the JCPOA.
So this would be that classic ability from Tel Aviv to try and have the tail wag the dog here. And there's so many points of interest about, you know, whether or not Biden will acquiesce as Trump did. But some would maybe say, Inlakesh, that perhaps if they had the might and the means to go ahead and back up the conversations that they're having publicly, we would have been seeing the result of that, not just hearing, you know, these thinly veiled threats here. Is this the situation that's been reflected online in public opinion?
Absolutely. The first one we've got here says, what reason is there that the whole world want dialogue, but Israel don't want it? Nobody wants Iran to have nuclear weapons, but why should Israel have them? The confidence in the ability to wage war against Iran is unwarranted, and someday Israel will bite off more than it can chew. We've got another one here as well commenting on this, who says, the fact that you are declaring this publicly tells us that this is just hot air. Israel do not have the capacity to launch a strike on Iran.
Right, so from one tense situation to another potentially tense situation. Robert, there were perhaps hopes that the new administration would have taken a more comfortable line when it comes to China. It seems that the new man in charge, well, maybe cut off the same old cloth there.
Well, Antony Blinken, who has just been sworn in officially now as Biden's Secretary of State, in his speeches and his responses delivered at the Senate confirmation hearing, he basically indicated all of what he would lay out in his foreign policy. And as you just said, it seems that he's taking a very similar approach to the Trump administration. In a few key areas, they have, of course, differing opinions. However, he sounds just like a John Bolton with more pretty language, and that's what a lot of people have been saying on this. And just so that this can be made clear, we've got a clip here from that Senate confirmation hearing in which he openly says that he aligns with the policy of Donald Trump when it comes to China.
I also believe that President Trump was right in taking a tougher approach to China. I disagree very much with the way that he went about it in a number of areas, but the basic principle was the right one, and I think that's actually helpful to our foreign policy.
So, a prettier Pompeo?
That's what it seems, and many people are bringing that up. They sort of have this veneer of being more progressive, and of course, the language that they use is a lot more professional, but that aura of professionality doesn't take away from the overall and the overarching theme that is presented by the likes of Blinken and Joe Biden, which is the same imperialistic intentions when it comes to conquering land, which they feel has too much Chinese influence, too much Russian influence, too much Iranian influence, or whoever else it will be inside of various regions throughout the world. And that's what we're seeing, aggressive actions, towards Venezuela, Russia, China, even in Lebanon as well. On top of that, it's a continuation of the Trump administration's strategy, maybe with the small exception when we're looking inside of the Middle East of its directions, specifically with Saudi Arabia at this time. But we still have to watch that and see that how that develops.
I think your first tweet here really gets to the heart of the matter, Rob.
Absolutely. The first one we pulled up here, and this is very important to note, this is from Sarah Abdullah, who says, Antony Blinken is a champion of the invasion of Iraq, NATO's destruction of Libya, arming Al-Qaeda in Syria, Israeli war crimes, Saudi Arabia's genocide in Yemen, the CIA-backed coup in Ukraine. His confirmation only means one more thing, more U.S. militarism worldwide.
Change the face, but not the policy. Your last mention of this before we head out.
The last one that we brought up here shows really the intellect of many in the U.S. who are looking at this. This is actually said seriously from Richard Smith here, who says, I think Antony Blinken will be the best Secretary of State since Henry Kissinger. Of course, we know the destruction that he caused.
We'll let that just hang over us like a bad smell. All right, Robert Imakesh, thank you. And thank you so much for spending your 25 minutes with us. Stay safe.
The Limelight.
Now that artificial intelligence, or AI, is providing an increasing number of recommendations to human decision makers, it is important to make sure that, as a technology, it is not biased, and thus respects the value of fairness. The article we are about to present you has been written jointly by Raja Chatila, a professor emeritus of artificial intelligence and robotics and ethics at Sorbonne University in Paris.